Imagine, if you will, 1973. A kid with not a lot of ag knowledge, really a city slicker, takes on the world of agricultural markets. Hi, I'm Susan Littlefield with the American Ag Network. The opportunity to sit down with the gentleman we are about to talk to about his outstanding career, 53 years in this ag market industry, as I mentioned, starting back in 1973. So grab yourself a cup of coffee, sit back, and let's join in the conversation with Mark Gold. As I asked him, did he ever think his career would end where it did?
Absolutely not. You know, I fully intended to spend my whole life, you know, in the trading pits. And, you know, I certainly didn't have the vision to see what was coming, you know, just, you know, 25, 30 years later, that would change everything from the pits to electronics. And, you know, I did go to the University of Illinois, graduated with a degree in agricultural economics. You know, this is when, you know, there weren't city kids in the College of Ag. I think I was one of maybe one or two kids that were in the College of Ag that were from the city. There were some other kids, but they were all in pre-vet. They weren't there for the real agricultural side of things, but I was. I'd worked on the floor of the Merck, and I wondered, you know, how do you raise soybeans? How do you raise cattle and hogs and all that? And I wound up going back to the University of Illinois and got a degree in ag econ.
What made you, being a city kid, see, I didn't know that about you. What made you want to be a broker and to be on the in the pit?
Well, you know, the funny thing is I went off to Tulane University in 1972 to become a doctor. That literally lasted 5 minutes into my first class when the professor started talking about calculus and math wasn't my real strong point. And some kid asked a question that was so far over my head. In that very moment, I watched my medical career go out the window. So, you know, what am I going to do now? I didn't like Tulane. I came home after a semester, was going to school at Loyola during the day and working at a sporting goods store at night. And then I met a cousin who owned a clearing firm at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And he asked me what I was doing that summer of 73. And I said, nothing. He goes, well, why don't you come be a runner for me on the trading floor? And I walked onto the trading floor, saw these guys yelling and screaming at each other, the colorful coats and the noise and the chaos. And I knew this guy was a very successful individual. I said, what are the hours? He goes, 9 to 1. I said, you know, this is right up my alley. And after about a year of being on the trading floor, working for him, there were so many things I didn't know about economics and livestock and grains. I said, I need a good education. And that's when I decided to apply to the University of Illinois. Eventually got accepted in the College of Ag. And just had a great experience there.
Talk to me about that experience on the floor. For many folks, they didn't get to see the opportunity of what a floor trading day was like. Can I kind of walk us through it? What excited you every morning to put on that coat and be a part of that very unique part of our marketing opportunities?
Well, you know, for me as a speculator, you know, all I wanted to do was be able to talk intelligently to people about the markets. And with that college degree, I was able to do that. I had no idea that I'd really get involved with farming, you know, later down the road. But in the pit, I was mainly in the soybean pit. And that was the biggest, that was the major leagues of commodity pits back in the day. And I was a 22-year-old kid. And I started with $3,000 in my account. And here I'm in a pit with, you know, literally 400 or 500 guys, seasoned traders, trying to hold my own. And, you know, the pushing and shoving and the kicking and the spitting and getting poked in the eye. And it was quite the experience. As they used to say, it was, you know, organized chaos. And I always told people, if they went up to the visitor's gallery, it's fine to look at the whole floor and to see all the chaos. But just single out one trader and just watch that one trader in the pit, and it slows it down to a microcosm, and you can see him or her bidding or offering and making a trade, and things became a little clearer than just looking at the forest and not looking at the tree. So, You know, it was something to be in that pit in the day. And, you know, what got you up every morning, what got you excited to be there is you had an opportunity to try to make money. If you were a good trader, you know, you had that ability to be your own boss and to do what you wanted to do. And I was very lucky. I was able to borrow $125,000 from a local Chicago bank. My dad co-signed the note. We put up some family stocks, and I borrowed $125,000, but my dad made it very clear to me he couldn't pay the interest or the principal. That was up to me. And I did cut a deal with the bank for the first year, just interest only. And by 1980, I didn't, had the seed paid off. So I was pretty fortunate to have some success pretty much from the beginning. And, you know, years later, and two divorces later, you know, I just, I couldn't do what I had done for so many years. And I was making money, but not enough to support either my first wife or my second wife. And wound up selling the seat, moving up to Platteville, Wisconsin to become a broker. And that's how I got involved with farmers. And I never thought I'd be in, you know, out in the country working with farmers on a day-to-day basis. And it turned out I loved it. And then I was fortunate enough to, there was a guy in the office by the name of Carl Babler, who was a broker there. And I said, what do you do? He says, well, you know, I'm a teacher at the university here at Platteville, but I also am a broker. And every year I get my farmers to buy a put option in the spring and buy a December put. And that's what we do. I said, well, what do you do when the market goes down? Nothing. What do you do when the market goes up? Nothing. I said, well, ever think about rolling that put down or rolling it up depending on what opportunity the market gives you? He said, no, but that's a good idea. And then the two of us started putting together a hedge program and started working with elevators and bankers around the country. And that's how the business took off.
I want to talk about that education side of it in just a moment, but I want to rewind to ask, did the CME make a mistake when they closed the pit?
Well, the original question should be, when the board and the Merck went public instead of being private companies, I think that was the mistake. It just, it allowed all these high-frequency traders and fund managers to just, you know, the little guy couldn't hold his own. And that's really what changed these markets. And I look back and I wish the markets never would have gone public. But they went public, they knew that they would be able to expand things, the high frequency trading and all that. And as a shareholder, you want the share value to increase. The way to increase the value of the shareholder is to have more volume. And the volume went, you know, which was what we thought good volume back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it went, you know, exploded. And the price of the stock exploded. And there was no turning back, really. There are a few pits that are left open. Frankly, I don't know why. But it changed the whole demeanor of the markets.
Did algorithms, as we see it today, how do you see that being such an influence? I mean, we know we get that instantaneous knee-jerk reaction. Good or bad for the markets?
I don't like it. You know, the numbers come out at 11 o'clock. The algos have their systems that pick out certain words, and they react within a fraction of a second. While I'm still looking at the data, the market's already moved. Who knows, 10, 20, 30 cents. And it doesn't give the little guy a chance to really get in it. You don't want to put a stop in. You know, you have no idea where that's going to get filled. And it could go up 30 cents, hit your stop, then go back down. And, you know, you're just out of luck. So I think it created a lot of volatility. I would have been okay with it, I suppose, if they would have had a five-minute window, stop the trading, let the numbers come out, and then restart it, where everybody's got a fair shot at it. But I think it gave them a huge competitive advantage that I never liked.
jump forward now to the education side of it, and you being in Wisconsin and getting to talk to farmers. You just, as I watched you over the years, have those interactions and those discussions, whether it was in a big group setting or an individual, you command the room. And Mark, when you talk, I mean, people listen and they want to hear the knowledge that you have. Did that come naturally to you, having those conversations?
You know, funny it did. You know, I've always lived by this one simple creed, really, that one of the real legends in trading taught me, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And that creed is, you can't buy integrity. So when you walk into the room, just be yourself, tell them what you really believe in. And if they like it, fine. If they don't, that's fine too. But don't try to sugarcoat anything. And tell them the facts as you see them. Either they like them or they don't. But I think, you know, there's the old saying on the farm, you know, anybody that talks to us that comes in from more than 50 miles away is an expert. And I think, you know, coming from Chicago, having been on the floor, that gave me some credibility. But without question, what really gave me that ability to walk into a room and have some credibility were the radios I did. KFRM, KVRN, some of the other shows, Red River Network, and some of the other things. So these, I've been doing it for so many years that people got to know me, they knew my voice, and they knew what I was about. And that gave me the ability to walk into that room and be able to talk to these people where they at least had some semblance of what I was about. So without all that exposure, and then the TV exposure certainly helped, and I enjoyed doing it. You know, before I got into trading, I always thought about becoming a teacher, and then the trading thing hit, and you know, I didn't really think about teaching anymore. But you know, I kind of always liked that idea of trying to impart some information to, whether it was, you know, kids in a school or to adults in a marketing meeting. And as it turned out, I had plenty of opportunities when I was a member of the board. Farm groups would come in. The Board of Trade knew my educational background, and they would have me talk to, you know, probably at least once or twice a month, talk to some farm group that was coming in. So, you know, I had some practice, and I was able to translate that from, you know, being in a classroom in Chicago to being on a stage, you know, somewhere in the middle of the country.
What commodity do you like to talk about and have discussions about with folks out of all the different agricultural opportunities out there?
Well, for me, it's always been soybeans. You know, when I walked into the Board of Trade, like I said, a 22-year-old kid, scared stiff, I went in the corn pit because that was the least volatile at the time. And I was trading my one contract. And the first 3 days, I made $37.50 each of the first 3 days. I said, you know what? I got a monthly interest bill coming due. Or not an interest bill, but an interest bill coming due. And this isn't going to cut it, making $37.50 a day. So a friend of mine said, go in the bean pit. That's where you're going to be able to do some good. So I walked in the bean pit, traded my one lots. And that was where I had 95% of the success in the business was in the soybean pit. And mostly, you know, in the big bull years, 80, 83, 88, those were the years where I was able to really accumulate some money.
If you had the opportunity, would you have, and maybe if things had changed a little bit, would you have stayed in the pit? Or did you see what you did post-pit time, out and about in, with farmers, talking on the radio, being on television, as a more vital part of what the career of Mark Gold was all about?
Well, you know, after the second divorce, you know, it hit me hard financially, and I wasn't trading well, and I was still married to my second wife, though we were about to go through a divorce, and I said, I need a job, and I sold the seat. Paid off my debts to the clearing firm. And you know, moved up to Platteville and, you know, not, I don't think I was up there 2 weeks when she decided that's it. We got a divorce and, you know, I was kind of, you know, there I was in Platteville, broke, a city kid in an agricultural town. And, I was pretty much a fish out of water, but, finding that hedge program is really what saved me. No question about it. You know, the American farmer adapting and relating to the hedge program that we were trying to explain to them, you know, that's where I got my success. So, you know, I'm always forever thankful to the American farmer for accepting me and deciding to work with me. You know, I was very fortunate that as a city kid, I could walk into a room in the middle of, you know, Keokuk, Iowa, or Bow Bells, North Dakota, and be able to, if I could convince 10% of the room, that was a pretty high batting average. But a lot of times it was more than that. And I had a wonderful time doing it. As a city kid, I saw more parts of this country, literally from, you know, Washington State to New York State, from Canada down to Texas, that not very many city folks have been able to see some of the sites I've been able to see and meet the people and have come away now 50-some-odd years later with some great friendships with ag lenders and farmers and all kinds of people in the media business, TV and radio. You know, I don't know how many city folk were able to do that. I don't think very many. So I've been very lucky in my life that, you know, I was able to come back. When I left Platteville in 2005, I was pretty much flat broke. I just had my third open heart surgery in 3 months. And the boss decided to let me go. And I was broke, half dead. Moved back to Chicago, found a job, and told the people that I was, let's build another company. I was very successful in Platteville doing what I'm doing. I can reconstruct it here. And then started that company and went off on my own in 2006 with Top Third. But I've had a lot of lucky breaks. Now, not very many people survive, as it turned out, 4 open heart surgeries in a year. And, you know, I was pretty much half dead, but I had faith in the Lord, and I figured the Lord put me where he wanted me to be when he wanted me to be there. And by the grace of God and the infinite mercy of Jesus Christ, I was able to survive and to move on. And, you know, I'm a pretty blessed guy. I have to say that, you know, there's a reason the Lord kept me around all this time. He had 4 good shots. He could have taken me at any time. And, you know, I was just lucky to be alive and lucky to be able to make a living and then start my company. So it all turned out great. But believe me, it wasn't a straight shot for 53 years from the bottom of the top and just staying at the top. I had many, many hiccups in between. I was flat broke twice, owed the government money, had to pay them back. It was one thing after another. But once I started my own company, that's when I got back on my feet financially. And, you know, it's not so much me. It's everybody I've worked with, the brokers, the media people, the bankers, the elevators that have allowed me into their homes. And I'm forever grateful for that.
You know, the good Lord obviously knew what he wanted you to accomplish, and he wasn't finished with you yet, and he still has. Even after retirement, I'm sure has a lot of things in store for you.
Well, I sure hope so. I hope it includes some travel and some fun. You know, like I said, we're here by the grace of God, and when he decides to call me home, you know, I have faith that I've lived a pretty good life and tried to help a lot of people, and hopefully he'll see fit to letting open the pearly gates for me.
Well, you know, I can't wrap up this conversation without getting your thoughts on the marketing world we're in right now. And, you know, everything, as we know, is so volatile, Mark. With the current world situations that we're seeing and farmers' windows getting shorter and shorter to pull the trigger or try to market and get sales set to go to make some profitability for their operation, what advice would you give them?
Well, I think you've got to be very careful with some of the brokers that are out there. They're not in it, in my opinion, to necessarily help the American farmer. They're in it to get a big acreage fee or to get a lot of commissions. And they know that odds are that any 10 clients that start in a given year, you know, 7 or 8 of them won't be there at the end of the year. And they have to keep getting more and more clients. And I see a lot of abuse of farmers in the industry with brokers that can talk a big game but can't back it up. And I've always said, don't ever ask a broker what he thinks the market's going to do. Because if any of us knew where the market was going to go, we wouldn't be telling you. But what I've always told him is, ask a broker what he knows. And what I always knew for the 25, 30 years I worked with farmers, I knew that if they bought a put option, they knew what their expense was. I knew they wouldn't get a margin call. And I knew that they were protected if the market went down, but they could make a lot more money if the market went up. Good today as it was 30 years ago, even with this volatility that we're seeing in here. Imagine all the farmers that, you know, some of these contracts that these elevators come up with, in my opinion, they aren't written necessarily to help the American farmer. I think there's some really bad contracts out there, and farmers need to be careful about them. You know, the elevators certainly have their job, and they're part of the marketing chain, and we need them to be there. The more, the merrier. But just be careful. I think the elevators should be there, you know, forward contracting is good. I think that's certainly the single best tool. But some of these other contracts that they've come up with, I just think it opens up the door for more problems than it solves. I've always said, just buy the done put, manage the risk, sell grain on the rallies, roll the put up or roll it down, depending on what opportunities are. You don't have to be a genius, but you have to be disciplined. And you have to be willing to try something. And that's what I tried to convince farmers all these years.
Well, Mark, thank you for what you did. Your brutal honesty, your looks sometimes to people when they would ask you a question was like, okay, you already know the answer, but here's what I think. And I just really appreciate all the years that we've had the opportunities to do interviews and talk about what you're seeing in the marketplace. You educated me. You educated so many. And though you said you thought about becoming a teacher, you really were a teacher. And you continue to do so as you head into retirement. And, of course, I wish you the very best. May there be lots of travel opportunities in front of you, both near and far, and spend some time with your beautiful bride.
Well, thank you very much. And you've been so kind to me over the years, and I appreciate the loyalty you've shown me. And I can't wish you anything but the very best for you and your family as well.
Thank you so much. Mark Gold joining us today as he steps off into sunset of retirement, but you know he'll still be keeping an eye on those markets. I'm Susan Littlefield.
Yes, ma'am, I will.
I'm Susan Littlefield reporting.